Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome once again to Madame Perry Salon. I am your host and cruise director, Madame Perry. You know, I just want to thank you all again. We've had such good shows lately, and I appreciate everyone subscribing to the show here on Blog Talk Radio, also iTunes and Stitcher. And it's because of your support of the show that I'm able to get such great guests like we've been having, and also great sponsors. And you know, lately, a couple of months ago, we had Rudy Sarzo from Quiet Riot, and that show gets a lot of downloads still. But you know, get his book, Off the Rails, about his touring with Ozzy Osbourne, and about the same time that his good friend Randy Rhoads died in the airplane accident. Get that book, because it's just an amazing snapshot in time, which is what tonight's show is going to be like as well. But also, it just seems to that... Oh, another popular show, Alison Arngrim. You remember her book is called Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, because most people know her as Little Nellie Olson from Little House on the Prairie. But Alison's story is fascinating. It's about growing up in show business. Her mother did voiceovers for, I think, Gumby and all the Dudley Do-Right shows and stuff like that. Lots of cartoons her mom did voiceover for. And her whole family was in the business about Little House on the Prairie and about her personal life. But let me tell you, she had some very rough times during the show. But she's also got a very kind of like an old school Hollywood showbiz sense of humor, and she's an absolute riot. So, and she's also an activist, just like Rudy Sarzo and his wife do a lot of animal activist work, and Alison Arngrim does a lot for children or orphans or people who have been victims of sexual assaults, particularly incest. So, yeah, get both those books. But I promise you, if you haven't heard or watched Alison lately or Little House, you'll see her in a whole different light. A very funny lady. She does a lot of stand-up, too, around the country. So, tonight, this gets better and better here. Tonight's guest, there's a documentary that you may have seen, it's been out a few years, called The Wrecking Crew. You know, there's a lot of bands that people grew up hearing music, hearing songs, whether it's from TV or movies or bands that we used to listen to. And it's called the soundtrack to our lives. And yet we had no idea until recently, if at all, that a lot of these weren't the bands we thought we were listening to, weren't the actual musicians, but they were pretty much the same bunch of people who were stellar, or as they say, I know at least in the jazz world, would say monster musicians. And I'm talking about the Wrecking Crew. And one of the most prominent people in the Wrecking Crew was a guitarist named Tommy Tedesco. Very revered among musicians, I can tell you. And his son, Denny, created a film called The Wrecking Crew, a documentary, actually. And Denny's with us tonight. Denny, come on into Madame Perry's salon.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, hello? Okay, I can hear you now. Yes.
Oh, perfect.
I can hear you.
That worked.
All right. Yay.
How are you?
How you doing,
yeah.
Denny?
I'm doing well. I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Good, good. Hey, you get all the comments, all the same comments all the time, and I hope you never get tired of them. But the Wrecking Crew documentary. Go ahead.
No, I said, go ahead. You first.
Okay, all right. I had heard about, you know, I had come to know who the Wrecking Crew was, and specifically some of the musicians in it, and within the last 10 or 15 years. And then a couple of years ago, my husband, I think he was on the way back from a trip. I think he was from Germany to the States for a business trip. And he said, I saw this documentary. And I think he even texted me before. As soon as he was through, he said, you've got to see this film. And he said, I never thought that I would be so emotional after watching a documentary that I was actually had. And man, he's a grown man. I mean, he's not, you know, he's a guy with feelings, but he's usually very well composed. But he said, I never thought I would have tears coming out of my eyes on an airplane like this, just out of emotion. And he said, it's amazing. This is, you know, for one thing, it's a soundtrack to our lives, but also because he's a musician. You know, he even had more respect for these people. But why don't you start off, since you created a film and it's brilliant. Tell us who, for people who don't know, I don't know how they wouldn't know, but who is The Wrecking Crew?
Sure. Well, The Wrecking Crew is basically, it was a moniker, a nickname, that if there's any questions, maybe came in much later, years later. But it's about the guys that were doing the sessions in the early 60s, late 50s, mid 70s. In Los Angeles, when in the early 60s, there was only one track to record on. So record companies, when they were doing the rock dates, they were concerned. They thought, you know, is this music going to last? And, you know, so they made sure that they covered their, you know, bets and made sure they had the good musicians, great musicians in the studio to do the tracks so that they could put the singers over and not have to worry about studio time. Well, those guys became the Wrecking Crew, and the reason they were nicknamed the Wrecking Crew were because supposedly Hal Blaine, who's a fabulous drummer of all, one of the greatest of all time, said, the older guys said, we're going to wreck the business playing this rock and roll stuff. And so that's how it started. So the first dates in the, you know, late 50s, these guys are breaking in. In the 60s, they're the Wall of Sound. They are the Wall of Sound with Phil Spector. Then Brian Wilson starts grabbing them, and Janet Dean are grabbing them. And it just, they're flying, you know, they're working around the clock now. And this lasted into the late 60s. And then, you know, when more tracks started coming around, you know, the bands were able to use their own, you know, musicians. They could, you know, do a guitar solo with no problem. You know, put it in later. If we can't, you know, if the guys can't nail it the first time, we could pick it up later. And so these were the guys. And one woman, Carol Kay. But like Hal Blaine was on drums. Earl Palmer was on drums. Joe Osborne on bass. Glenn Campbell on guitar. My father, Tommy Tedesco, on guitar. I mean, there's no set thing as a Wrecking Crew, but a group of guys that were just nonstop working.
Just sort of a collective or a pool of people who everyone, if you call them, you got the best.
And, absolutely.
And they were all good at working with each other. I mean, Carol.
Yeah,
I know there
Carol. Yeah.
I think there's a part where Carol Kay, you know, said, "Oh yeah, you know, she took some, you know, some heat from some guys a few times, and she gave it right back." Respected her, you know, they said,
right.
Hey, Carol, you play pretty good for a girl. Really? You know what? You play pretty good for a guy. And they, you know, that's the way they had fun.
Exactly.
And
you know, then Glenn Campbell and Leon Russell was another one of the early session guys. And Glenn said it perfectly. He said, when I was playing in a room, don't forget there's maybe 10, you know, 15, maybe 3. It didn't matter how many guys were in the room. You had to nail that track perfectly because you had 3 hours. Technically, if it's a union gig, it was 3 hours, and you were allowed to only do 3 or 4 songs in those 3 hours, because what the union didn't want is, you know, putting out tracks left and right and just working themselves out of a job. So they made sure they slowed it down at least a little. But doing 3 or 4 songs in 3 hours – not many people could do that. You know, you could do an album a day, and that's what they would do for Liberty Records. They were doing an album a day. You know, 6 songs in the morning, 6 songs in the afternoon. And, you know, these guys could do it. And like Glenn said, he says, listen, it was like playing with Michael Jordan in that room. Everybody was a Michael Jordan. You know, there was no popping in, you know, like, hey, I'm going to pop in and just pick up here. We didn't have those computers at that time. So you start from the beginning.
Oh, yeah, that's right, that's right. You didn't just, yeah, okay, well, we'll fix it in post or in the mix. Mm-hmm. We'll drop it in and out. This was the real thing. This was cooking from scratch. And I guess, too, so many of the players, you know, musicians, if they've worked together a lot, seem to get a bit of telepathy between them.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, so that, and just amazing. I've got a clip I want to play. It's from the trailer. And I think mm-hmm. the people on here are your father, Tommy Tedesco, Carol Kay, I think Brian Wilson, Glenn Campbell. And you can tell us, this over. It's just about 2 minutes. I'm going to play that now.
Good vibrations. Right. You must have did 25, 30 seconds.
It might take 6 months.
Yeah. Some days that we worked 5 minutes, some days we worked 4 hours.
Yeah. On the same song.
We experimented, and they would ask me, well, what do you want? And I'd say, well, I don't know, you know. And we'd go home, and the next time we get together, then we would fall together, and we'd do the thing.
3 months, 2-3 dates a week, but Capitol Records was picking up the tab.
And we liked to work for him. The word was, do you have a date with Brian Wilson tomorrow? Yeah, I do. Oh, good.
Well, Carol played on Good Vibrations and California Girls, and she was like the star of the show. I mean, she was the greatest bass player in the world. And she was way ahead of her time. She would play a tonic and a fifth or a third instead of a fifth, you know. She was one of the first bass players to start playing that way.
But he definitely wrote out some neat lines on the bass, like, for instance, I'd have never played that. I'll just go into this. Now, that's a jazz walking line. You knew that this kid was into something really, really great.
The room had a spirit to it, with Hal being the leader, you know, and all the guys working together and thumping and pumping.
He would get things like he wanted to hear them. And when he got them that way, it was good. When I heard Good Vibrations the first time on the radio, it just blew me away.
She's somehow close now. Softly smile, I know she must be kind.
I remember Carol, though. I still have to remember, because her favorite thing, no matter what date we went on after that, would you like me to use my Beach Boy pick? And so she'd impress the shit out of her. This one. And
she picked it up on her way to the studio.
And they're looking at this pick, and they're looking at her.
Yeah,
and
I, you know.
She was selling this shit like I couldn't believe. One little pick made this girl hundreds of thousands of
okay.
So that was funny.
That's
the section in the film.
Yeah, and I think that's your dad at the very end, guitarist Tommy Tedesco, talking about teasing her about her Beach Boy pick.
Oh, yeah. There's one thing they could do is they bust each other's chops all the time. And he was good for if he could sell the BS better than anyone. I mean, but he could also bust you with the BS as well. So, I mean, he was the king of, you know, of that. I mean, there was moments where someone was, like Lalo Schifrin, I heard of recently, Lalo Schifrin was one of the great jazz composers and movie composers.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, Tommy, can you give us some flamingos on some movie? And once you see the movie, you know what he can do with his Spanish guitar. He rips through it. He says, do you want it like this? And he rips through the fretboard, you know, playing his Spanish licks. Or do you want it like this? And he'd rip through it, but he'd be slapping the body of the guitar. He goes, that's the DiCincenzo style. And Lalo goes, you know, give me the DiCincenzo style. And then my father would turn around and tell the kids, the seminar kids, he said, the DiCincenzo style is a guy, he was a bricklayer in Niagara Falls where I grew up, and he doesn't play guitar. But he just would, he says, as soon as he gave him a name for something, he knew he was supposed to be the expert, my father. So that was it. He would sell the BS.
And I've been telling people too, if when you start this, you know, we're sorry, so sorry to hear your father passed away, but he was still alive when you started making this film, and I know you wanted to get this done. You know, while
he was
still
that was the start of it. That was he was passing away in 96, and I wanted, you know, I wanted to tell that story for years. I was in film, and I was, you know, documentaries and stuff, and I thought, this is a great thing, and I started it. And Dad was still alive, but he didn't see anything because we were shooting in film at the time, which was very difficult to work with. And finally, Dad passed in 97. I started this 14-minute teaser in 98, tried to get people to help, and no one would help. And it was all about economics, which we all know is, you know, they say you'll never make your money back, and no, why would any investor put his money into something when it's going to be, you know, never, you know, get their money back? Well, I had to keep on going, and I did everything wrong, credit cards, refi, and all that stuff. But we finally got it out in 08, and we did extremely well with the festivals. But again, we could not release until we paid the 110 songs off. And people say, oh, the record companies. You know what? It wasn't them. The record companies gave us great deals. Labels gave us great deals. It's just having the belief that, you know, and you know what? We finally did it. It came out. It did extremely well. Like you saw it, your husband saw it on a flight from Germany or from Europe. And it's on Netflix now. If you haven't seen it, it's on Netflix. And but the DVD was the most special thing for me because I got to put 6 hours of bonus material on it.
And I'm glad you brought that up because I was going to say if you haven't seen it or you haven't watched it, you know, yeah, you can watch it on Netflix, whatever, but I'm going to say go ahead and buy the DVD, get your own copy because you do, yeah, you get 6 hours of bonus. And I love how you have on the bonus CD is like set up like a jukebox. You can be like, well, do I want to hear the bass players talk? Do I want to hear the guitar? You know, it's like you can just, it is just done so beautifully and so well. I just love
Thank
it.
You.
I've got a caller coming in here, and I think it's from South. Oh, you're quiet. Welcome. Hey, we are thanking you all the way on this. I've got a caller coming in, and I think it's Mr. Duffy Odom, who visits our show a lot from South Georgia. Hi, Duffy Odom.
Hi.
Hello. Hey.
Hi, and hi, Mr. Tedesco. I'm honored to meet you.
I'm just honored to be here. Thank you.
Your father, it was a and the entire wrecking crew are legends. I'm glad that everybody's getting to know who they are and who they were. It was strange to me hearing Carol Kay talk about this kid Brian Wilson.
Yeah.
Brian Wilson is certainly no kid now, and I think Carol's in her early 80s. And they're all getting up there.
Yeah.
And I saw in the interviews you have a lot of people who it was so neat to see some of these people because they're no longer here. Dick Clark talk about I'm so glad that you started it when you did. Even though it took you a long time and it was a struggle to get it out, I'm glad that you started early. Apparently this was a dream of yours even before your dad passed, that that you wanted to, it seemed like you wanted to say something.
Because you got them
all together around the table with your dad. That was such a special moment, and for it to go back that far, where you could actually see them. Hal Blaine has always been a, you know, people that were doing records and people that knew things about records always liked to. You didn't like to tell everybody that you knew that was Hal Blaine playing the drums because you knew something special. That's a Sonny and Cher record, but we know that's Hal Blaine.
Right.
We know who that is. Sonny might have produced it, but that's Hal Blaine. And then we learned Carol Kay, and you were right about And the people that came out when your dad died and said, you don't know who this is, but you've heard him a million times, and we certainly have.
Right.
The countless numbers of hits and the different genres from crazy rock and roll to Sinatra and
yeah,
they were just able to play everything.
You said something that was interesting. You said I got them early, and you know what? I got to be honest with you. If the timing wasn't right. It's two things. If this film had come out when it was supposed to come out, you know, like, you know, a few years after I started, it would never have had the legs because of just the spread of the internet helped this film, you know. And then things came up later, and you know, last year, I was able to pull in Leon Russell. Leon didn't want to do it at the beginning, and then he finally came around after I had already gotten it out. Or not gotten it out, but finished the first run. And he came through. And the other thing is, if I had to make it now, yes, so many of them have passed. Dad passed, Earl Palmer passed, Al Casey, you know, so many folks have passed on. And it wouldn't, or age. Age makes a huge difference. And when these guys are in their early 60s, they aren't in the game anymore. They got nothing to lose.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They could tell the truth. If it was 10 years before, they might not tell the truth. They're still playing that game. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did love your dad was such a virtuoso. I did love the seminar that you were talking about where he not only plays, every one of them is practically Latin. But he makes a different genre every time.
Yeah.
They're shooting this in Bolivia. They need a Bolivian song. They're shooting this in Mexico. We need a Mexican song. And just goes through five or six different kinds of Latin styles that he knows right off the top of his head.
Yeah.
It's absolutely amazing, the talent that your dad had.
And I asked my father, I said, tell me the difference between a session player and a specialist. Now, a specialist is someone that they're bringing in because they want Eric Clapton's, they want his sound, or they want B.B. King's sound, or they want Segovia's sound. But you said a session player, there's a door there. You don't know what's behind the door. So you go behind the door, you sit down at the seat the first time, and you got a piece of music there. It's asking for mandolin. It's asking for classical guitar or Spanish. Or it's asking for jazz or rock. He says, we have to come as close as possible to make it right, to make it sound like we are the experts. But you can't ask B.B. King to put a piece of music down and read it, or Eric Clapton, for the matter. I don't think Eric reads, I'm told. Or you can't ask Eric to play classical guitar. So you got to these are guys that are well rounded all the way around. And you know, and it's a you know, my dad's favorite. Someone asked him, "What was your favorite you know thing that you recorded?" And he said, "Listen, I did all those you know the rock and roll stuff. I worked on Beach Boys, or I did the you know worked on the Batman theme or this theme and whatever." He said, "But you know when." Years later, when he got into the movie work with John Williams and James Horner and all those guys, when Horner and Williams said, "Hey, Tommy, listen, we got a film, a Cocoon, or Field of Dreams in a few months in September. Just leave the first 2 weeks open first for us, and then I'll let you know." That's when you knew you made it, because nobody.
Yeah.
There's only two. There's,
yeah.
You know, there's. They're asking for Tommy. They're not asking for a guitar player. That's when you know you've made it. Because anybody could play the Telecaster for the stuff he was doing. You know, there's 12 other guys that would have filled that.
Horner and John Williams. They were just. That's as far as you can go. I mean, they are masters. They are the masters. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great.
And there was a thing too that you mentioned about, you know, it's got to be, it's not a guitarist, you've got to have Tommy Tedesco, you know, or you've got to have people they know who they want. what was it, about a week, almost 2 weeks ago, I had been to see, you know, the Todd Rundgren's on tour right now with his Chival Rock show. And so I've been to that, and so the bass player, Chasm Sultan, has been on Madame Perry's Salon, and he's coming back soon. But he had given us backstage, you know, pass an invitation to come back and talk to the guys and him after the show. So, you know, we're back there, and I said, you know, my husband and I are going, well, look, we know these guys are tired. They played 2 hours straight. It's Prairie Prince, you know, from the Tubes, Greg Hawks from the Cars, the place that's been playing with Todd for years, Jesse Gress. A mighty guitar player, a monster, as we say in jazz, who has written several books on music. And of course, Chasm Sultan, the bassist who, you know, who invited us back, who's played with everybody, you know, Joan Jett, Celine Dion, Meatloaf. And so so I said, you know, we thought we're just going to say hello since we've been invited back. And said, you know, but leave them alone because these guys are tired. They've done hard 2 hours. And just, you know, this. And so Chasm's saying, hey, you know who you ought to have on your show? You ought to have this guy, Prairie Princess. Oh, okay, well, I'll ask him, hey, Prairie, he's going, you ought to have this guy, Jesse. You ought to have this guy. So I'm thinking, great, I'm the luckiest girl in the world. I've got this, I've got a musician booking musicians on my show. And he goes, well, what's going on with it? And I go, well, I've got this, I've had so-and-so, and I've got this. And then I said, and then just before I said, Denny Tedesco, you know, my husband goes, yeah, and she's got Denny Tedesco. And I remember, these guys, especially, you know, Jesse and Greg, they're all very tired. They're getting ready to go back. And their heads come straight up, and they go, Tommy Tedesco's son? Tommy Tedesco's son is coming on your podcast? You know? And I go, yeah. And they go, oh, man. And from there, then Prairie Prince got into a conversation to give me his. After that, you got between Chasm Sultan and knowing Tommy Tedesco's son. I mean, these guys were putting down, you want my personal phone number? Do you want my cell phone number? Do you want my email? You know, and they're writing it all down the same paper, so I'll have it all together and not lose it. But these people, they just came. So then my husband ended up having a chat, a talk with Greg and Jesse and Chasm about the Wrecking Crew film, and he's saying, they're talking about all the people, you know, your dad, Carol, Earl, everybody in there. And it just tickles me to no end, Denny. And I thought, if you know, if even if you saw it and you see it a lot, I know it still means just as much to you every time.
You know, it's funny because someone said, are you tired of, for years it was like, are you tired of talking about it? And that was before it was released. And I was like, well, I was not tired of talking about it. My mom was always asking, God bless my mom. She was always worried about, how's it going, sweetie? How's it going? You know. And then it was like, once it got released, people assumed I was tired of it. I said, no, because I'm not really watching the film now. I'm watching the audience. And I'm watching every audience get something out of it, which was so cool. Like you said, you know, I had people walking up at the end in tears, grown men that were in tears, or women in tears, because, listen, we got lucky, you know, in a sense. You know, that music is 50% of the film right there. So we already know we've sucked them in with the music. But you got to have more than the music. And these folks, they're giving their soul. They're telling you the truth about life. And it's not just about, you know, one of the great lines for me was from Plas Johnson, the great sax man. And he said, I said, listen, how do you affect your personal life? You know, being in the studio 24 hours and hustling for years and da-da-da. And he paused and he said, listen, he said, let's just say I'm a better grandfather than I am as a father. And I knew exactly what he meant, you know, because we all, you don't have to be a musician. You could be anybody just trying to make a living. And you'll let your family life go because, you know what, it's not because you're being selfish, you're trying to survive. And that was what it was about. So I think we all in that film were affected in different ways. Father was passing away. Everybody's parents passed away. Our careers are in question. We all question it. What are we doing? What did we do? So I think that's why it hit home for everybody.
Well, these guys are saints because, and they do a service for us. I mean, you know, even soldiers will admit that, or moms, or dads, or like with me, people my age, I was born in 1950. This is the soundtrack of 90% of my life.
Yeah.
It's just about, and it's probably 90% of the music that I listen to.
Yeah.
And that was when music was shared.
Because it never stopped. Song after song after song after song. Yeah. And one of those guys was playing on almost every one of those records.
Yeah.
And
amazing to believe. It's absolutely amazing, and no wonder people are in tears.
Yeah.
Somebody else coming in. Pardon me, guys. Someone else coming into Madame Perry Salon here. Welcome to Madame Perry Salon. Come on in through the beaded curtains. And I think I know who this is. Hello? Hi.
Hello.
Madame Perry Salon. Hello. Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing just fine.
Is this Vincent Levy Bryant?
This is Vincent Levy Bryant. How you doing?
Doing
Hi, Vincent.
Good. Also,
I love the technology. I love how you do that. That's awesome. How you doing? How's everybody?
We're doing good.
Good.
Me, Denny Tedesco, Duffy Odom, and you know we were trying to say before you came
in. I'm humbled and I'm honored.
No, I'm the luckiest person in the world to have everybody here. But we were just starting to talk, too. And of course, as I was saying, you know, with Vincent being a musician, but also because he'd worked at A&R in New York back in, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say when. But
sure, it's okay. We're in our late 50s, 60s or whatever. You know, it was definitely late 70s, early 80s.
I was about to say, Vincent, tell me how you think. But you know, Denny, and we've talked about this before with musicians on the show, back then too, I mean, your dad and the other Wrecking Crew members, since they did not only music, like they were Phil Spector's Wall of Sound, they worked with Sinatra, they did a lot of things on the Grassroots and Beach Boys, they did all this music for people, Sonny and Cher, Jan and Dean, the Monkees, Jerry Lewis and the Playboys, Mamas and Papas, Tijuana Brass, Johnny Rivers, everyone. But, you know, we were saying, too, back then, that was also when music was a shared thing, not like now where it's solitary. For one thing, you had that scarcity, so you had to get excited and wait for it to come to your store and save your money and go buy it. And then when you did, you got together with somebody. You know, people came over.
You sat down and put an album on it, and you had to get up.
And your friends came over to listen, or people came on, or somebody came over to visit. Yeah. Hey, I got the song, you know, I got the Beach Boys record, you know, or whatever. And come on to my room. And everybody would, that was a shared group experience. So when people say it's a soundtrack to your life, it's not to your solitary life, it's to relationships and family and friends and courting and marriage and everything. And so you know that your dad, you know, and all the other musicians, Plash Johnson and Jay Migliori, everyone, they were, you know, I know they were your dad, but they were part, you know, your dad and everybody's family members, but they were part of our lives too.
Yeah.
And
you know, it's interesting is the other thing is when these guys were all making these albums, do you realize they didn't know 90% of the stuff they were working on? They had no idea. They had no idea. Even to this day, many have no idea what they did. Sometimes they think they did something they did. But it was the reason was because they were, you know, Dad went to work, let's say, three or four times a day for years. And he would go to different studios. And every time you went to a studio, you were given a piece of music. You had to read something different. Every song is different, unless it's a standard or a record.
That's
so
exactly
every time
what
you're
happened.
Doing that, and don't forget, and like Vincent knows, that nothing is a hit. They're not recording hits. They're recording songs that become hits. It's up to Vincent and everybody else to work. Now they've done their share. Now months go by, and all of a sudden, a great example was Up, Up, and Away.
Jimmy Webb gave my father a charm, a Grammy charm, when it won the Grammy. And my father said, well, what was this for? He says, it was for the Grammy we won for Up, Up, and Away. We recorded it last year. My father had no idea he was even on it. And if you listen to it now, if you know Tommy's playing, you go, "How? That's him. That's him ripping across the keyboard in the background." But the thing was, there were no vocalists. The Fifth Dimension came in later to lay that stuff down. So they're only there for, let's say, 3 or 4 hours. They're doing 1, 2, 3 songs, and they're moving on to the next one. It's gone. By the end of the day, you forgot what you did at the beginning of the day. So,
the thing is,
that time period, everybody was involved. There was the producer, the engineer, the A&R guys, the radio pushers, you know. Everybody had a piece of something to make sure it worked. And if it came together, great. But if it's a horrible song, as they say, you can't polish a turd,
It would never make it as a horrible song. Those guys were so sharp back then. Those guys would never even go in a studio with a song that they were not sure that they could work it somewhere, you know?
Yeah.
Those guys were so – they were geniuses, all of them.
You know, and, you know, I just – you know, something. The other thing is people always talk about today's music. Oh, it's not like it used to be. Here's the problem for today. I mean, this is my philosophical thing. There is a Brian Wilson, a Paul McCartney, and Jimmy Webb out there. They are out there. The problem is when you were talking about, you were saying about the, when the songs came out, well, don't forget we only had 3 rock stations in L.A. maybe at the time. There were no computers, there was nothing, and there were only a few labels, or the labels were there. But there was sometimes a hit would be on the East Coast and then never make it to the West Coast or vice versa. And so none of that was happening. And then all of a sudden, everybody's recording. Anybody could record. Now, we have thousands and millions of ways of hearing a song. But you know what? And there's only 24 hours a day. And that's split up between TV, computer, family. You know, we didn't have all the stations. And, you know, TV was limited, too. So we spent time listening to music.
Yep,
so it's out there. You just gotta find the right song for you.
There and what I've read, an article in the Atlantic about these people in Denmark that have this formula where they put people into a studio with these computers and their sense of vocals, and they make the music, send it back out, and they said, okay, this is going to be the next hit. This is going to be the next hit. And this is going to be the next hit. And they're, like, already produced as hit records, and they'll stay a hit for 2 or 3 weeks, and they'll make millions of dollars. And then the people will go out on tour with the digitized music and travel all over the world and then come back and... Nobody, by the time they get back, there's somebody else going out with the digitized product. They're actually out somewhere else making product to send all over the world to be a hit. And it could have anybody's name on it. It could be Brandy. It could be anybody.
Well, guess what? It's no different than it was done years ago. It's
That's
the same
right.
thing.
Yeah.
Don't, you know, my father, don't forget, the biggest hustle before Milli Vanilli was the instrumental groups. You know, when the Ventures were doing their things, there was the Marquettes and the Routers and the T-Bones. These were made-up groups. And, you know, what they did is my father and Leon and Hal and Earl, they went in, did the same stuff, just changed the title. The producer, Joe Ceresino, just changed the title of another group and said, this will be for the Routers.
It's the same thing. Yeah,
it's the same thing. It's a business, you guys.
Yeah, practically,
it's always
practically
gonna be business
same thing.
First.
But you don't have the master musicians sweating it out. You know,
no, you don't.
Day.
You got these producers, these kids. The producers now, they're all computer based. They have the samples, they have the controller keyboard, and everything is processed. You know, the old school method our dads came from was totally about they were the drum machine, you know. They were the ones. So, hey, anyway, man, it's my honor to be here. I'm going to check your book out, man. You're awesome. I know you come from awesome people. And those songs, man, I'm 58 years old on July the 5th. I grew up with all those songs. I'm a musician. I know how it is. And I just, God bless you, man. You know, do well.
All right,
well, here's
the DVD
the
is one.
Yeah. Bye.
While you're saying that, bye-bye. Vincent, we love you. Get the
love
DVD.
Love you right back.
Because
all right.
I love you, sweetie. Got the DVD, you get
right.
6 extra hours.
And if, you,
cool
if you're
stuff.
Looking for a book, guys, the greatest book right now that I've seen is by Ken Sharp, who wrote, it's called Sound Explosion. It is a 12 by 12 inch a coffee table book with interviews from everybody from Lou Adler and Herb Alpert to the Righteous Brothers. But Brian Wilson does the foreword on it. It's the most beautiful book out there, and it's their words. It's a beautiful book. So if you catch that, you could go to my website and get it at the WreckingCrewFilm.com site, because I don't know if it's still on Amazon. I think a little, but if you go to our site, then I know I'll get it to you.
All right.
Great.
You know, there was, all right. Thanks so much, Vince. There's also, I know there's, and just quotes from different reviews. John Caramonica of New York Times said, "The Wrecking Crew does raise the question of why players of this caliber were so content in the shadows. And were they content in the shadows? Or were they, they're just happy to be working."
That you said it. Here's the thing. It's interesting because, all right, let's go. Most of these guys are coming out of the jazz era. You know, jazz is, you know, they're coming out of World War II as kids. Dad was never supposed to be a guitar player for a living. That was just by fluke. But a lot of these guys are coming out of there. They're just, oh, my God, we're getting paid. We're getting paid to be in a studio and make $60 for 3 hours. You know, that's phenomenal in 1963, at $20 an hour or whatever it was. And he didn't care. My dad didn't. It's, even in the film, I think he says it. He says, listen, some people said, chance you've been paid more because you're rearranging on the spot or you're doing your own licks and this and that. He says, absolutely not. He says, that's my job. I'm there to make the guy smile. If he's smiling, I'm doing my job. Then I'll get another job from that guy. That's what you do. He says, don't forget, he says, you know, I made hundreds of hits, but I made thousands of bombs, and I never gave anybody their $25 back. You know, so you're just constantly working it. You know, and, you know,
yeah.
That's why, so it's like you can't, listen, if you were, the other line is, which actually was Bone said it, but he said it, but my father had said it to him. He says, you're only too busy to say yes. What is it? You're only too busy to say no when you're too busy to say yes or something. Basically, you take everything until you can't take it anymore. But you can't turn down things because sooner or later, you're going to hit something. You want to take everything at that point. Because, you know, you're learning at that point. You're making connections. You're making money. Sometimes people say, well, he's just playing a bunch of crap music. Yeah, but that, you know, that's not his opinion. It might be his. My father might have thought it was about, listen, my father, with the music he played, I would say he didn't like 70% of it. You know, and that's the truth. He comes from an old, but he never said that to the artist. Never, you know what I mean? Never said to the producer. His job is to make it work. And he think, you know, he said, if I think it should go this way, I'm going to make the best shot at it. If the guy doesn't like it, why not play it like he wrote it? But, you know, he's the other guy's paying, you know, writing the check. And I just do what he wants.
Mm-hmm. And I would
think that stars especially would appreciate people that don't that don't say, hey, is my name going to be on the record? And, you know, am I going to get any credit for this? Or, you know, if this is a hit, do I get more money? Or, you know, they stay in the background. They keep their mouth shut and they get respect because they don't make waves and they are consistently experts.
Well, here's the other thing. Don't forget, guys, LPs are running. It was different. In the jazz era, when you had LPs, they had the respect to have the credits on there. You knew Miles was playing. You knew, you know, Tony Williams was playing. But now we're talking about the most of the early 60s, it's 45s or singles. There's nowhere to put a credit. Now the LPs come around, long play. It wasn't – a lot of these guys, they didn't really care. They wish they would have later.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't something that they were looking for. Only occasionally you knew, hey, we can't put our name on it because it's the Beach Boys. You know, like Petty.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't tell me years later. Or Association were specifically said to Bones Howe, no, you could use the players, but you can't put their names on it. You know, so that, that's the way it was. And that wasn't the guys getting upset about it, meaning like my father didn't really launch it. As long as at the end there's a contract and there's a check, that's all they care about.
Yeah.
It was
that
also
one
probably
check. One
it?
Check for the whole thing. Yeah.
What was it? A good way for people to who were jazz players to continue having good work. I'm thinking of people like Barney Kessel, who most of what I know of Barney Kessel is not only his work of his own, but also his playing with Julie London.
Oh yeah.
And people like that, and Julie and Bobby and Bobby Troup. But this guy, you know, enabled him to keep on working.
Yeah,
what a magnet. And I guess Earl Palmer.
Yeah. And don't forget, these are dates. You know, you've just doubled your. If you can go from the jazz to the rock, you just doubled your income, because a lot of guys can't play both ways. I mean, you know, rock is easier to play for a jazz guy, but you can't take a rock guy and throw him into a jazz world. It's a totally different world. But for Barney and my father and Earl and Carol, going from the jazz world to the rock thing was not a big deal. But you know. And they're feeling, if Barney's doing a straight ahead jazz thing, he's booked. But you know what? Next week, you know, or maybe tomorrow, he's got Sonny and Cher. And he's doing Sonny and Cher. But it wasn't a big deal for, and don't forget, jazz guys, you know, especially in LA, at this time, I think in the city, well, forever. I mean, it's very difficult to make a living at jazz. You know, and it just made it, you know, over the years, it got worse and worse and worse. You know, but, you know, that's the way it was, and you just fill in the blanks with all these other calls.
Tell me what it was like. You had so many people who had worked with your dad and the crew, and that came on and talked about them in the video. I mean, in your documentary, I'm thinking about Nancy Sinatra, Cher.
Right. Well, I mean, Brian Wilson and. Well, I mean, I have on the what do you call it, on the DVD, there's so many more. Jackie Shannon, Bill Medley, Barry McGuire, there's so many people. But what was interesting is when people go, you know, if you can get past the gatekeeper of anybody, and I told them what I was doing. If I got to Cher, and Cher's agent was the one that got asked. And I knew Cher's agent. She actually asked, and I think when she called me back, said Cher said she'll do it. I could hear the surprise in the agent's voice, because I think she never thought, you know, well, you know, Cher's not going to do this. But no one knew. That's when Cher was 16, 17. That's in the days. Even I saw the Billboard Awards. I think it was the other night, and she gave a shout out to the Wrecking Crew. The lady, 71 or 72, and she gives out a shout out to the Wrecking Crew. On national TV. That's how much it meant to her, these guys, because they were like her big brothers. And same thing with Herb. He was there at the beginning when he's doing, you know, the bar mitzvahs.
And, you know, and he's working with, you know, Steve Douglas and Julius Wechter and all these guys in the early days. They all came from the, you know, don't forget. And I, the other question I asked everybody, were you ever intimidated by the artist? And they said, no, never intimidated. Now, don't forget, Brian, my dad in 1960, 30 years old. Brian Wilson is only 19, 20 maybe. I can't even think about it. I think he's even younger at that point. And so these kids are, they're still kids to the parents, or the parents, kids to these musicians. The only one they were intimidated by, or they said, not intimidated, but more on, you know, get it right, was Sinatra. Because that's someone they all looked up to. You know, they're 15 years, he's 15 years older than them. You know, so it's a different, you know, you're dealing with Sinatra, you're dealing with Ella, it's a, you know, it's a different genre, and it's, you know, you could hear the difference. But, you know, as my father said, he's never met a, you know, in terms of someone said, well, if a composer writes something, you know, a writer or artist writes something for guitar, don't you feel it's wrong to change it? He says, absolutely not. He says, I've never met a better composer that was a better guitar player than me. They aren't guitar players. Do you know what I'm saying? They're composers, but they're not guitar players. And his job is to make that composer's piece work and flow as beautiful as it can be. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a thing I was thinking about when I heard Carol Kay talking about The Beat Goes On. I know Sonny was a producer, and Sonny was a drummer, and Sonny knew something about music. But I know there had to be people that came up, and I think Nancy Sinatra comes to mind, despite her dad and everything else. You get somebody in there in the studio that knows nothing about music, and these charts are just thin pieces of basic boom boom, and you've got to make a song out of it. You've got to try to make a hit out of it. And that makes all of these people, all of the wrecking crew, composers in a way. They're arrangers. They have to arrange it on the spot. They have to say, no, this should go like this, and this should go like this, and this should go like this, and let's hit it. And you did three or four takes of it, and that's it. Composers, even known polished composers and arrangers can't really do that. That's people like Quincy Jones and the Masters that do that.
The other way, Brian Wilson though knew exactly what he wanted, and the guys would look at him like,
"He's the other end of the spectrum."
But and they would say, "Wait,
he's the other end of the spectrum.
Work."
He can say, "Yeah."
Mm-hmm. And then they'd come out and was like, "Wow, that does work. How'd that happen?" You know, he knew what he was doing.
He seems to be the exception to the rule of what every one of them says. Every one of them seemed to look up at Brian Wilson like he's the one guy that knew exactly what he wanted and had the sound in his head before he walked into the room.
Yes.
And it seemed like everybody else, you had to do the work. But with Brian Wilson, no, you know.
Yeah.
But I love Carol Kay and that beat goes on. When we walked in, it went boom, boom, boom. And she's the one that came up with that classic bass line that you think about when you think about beat goes on. Mm-hmm. And those when I think about the thousands of riffs that we know that are your dad's and that are Hal Blaine's and that are Carol's, it's just amazing.
What did you say?
Well, I think Danny, the other side of that though would be somebody like Phil Spector, who also knew exactly what he wanted, but he was known for wearing them completely out.
Yeah, Phil was a different animal. Phil was, you know, the reason if you look at his guitar section, he had all the jazz players in the guitar section. He had my father, Barney Kessel, Howard Roberts, Carol. Always from the jazz world, except then he had Henry Diltz, the great photographer, would do some banjo stuff. But he was always on the guitar thing because he was studying guitar. He actually studied guitar from Bill Pittman as well as Howard Roberts. So in the movie, when we talk about Howard Roberts just picked up his guitar and left because Phil was just giving him a hard time because he wanted him to play a chord a certain way, this and that, da da da. And Howard was the god of chord guitar. I mean, he knew that stuff inside and out. And finally, he just said, "That's enough. I'm out of here." You know, Phil would just drive them nuts. But you know, it's how you go into it with what attitude you're going to bring to the session. You know, can I laugh?
Yeah.
It? You know, my father said, if you're going to upset, if you're going to lose it, just remember you're not coming back. That was what I learned on this film.
Mm-hmm. You know, something else, well, Beth, during the interview, and people listening live know that we're talking to Denny Tedesco, filmmaker, creator of the Wrecking Crew documentary, which features his father, guitarist Tommy Tedesco, as well as a lot of other people, Plash Johnson, Glenn Campbell, Al DeLore, Bill Pittman, Jay Migliori, Ray Pullman, some of the great, most fantastic people that you may have never heard of, but you've heard their music. But one thing I want to know, in a lot of the interviews, Denny, your listeners talk, especially the one from the clip that I played where there's your dad, the scout and the guys are sitting around, and you know, like you said, you know, your dad and Carol like to bust each other's chops and have fun, and they had that wonderful, wicked, you know, musician sense of humor. But what I want to know is, while you were filming this, or video, while you were creating this, while you were getting all this recorded and sitting there in people's presence, and they're talking about things that they've done, here's what I want to know. Years ago, I used to go and work merch table in different places for Anita O'Day. Because when I found out she was still alive, I got to know her manager. And the bad news, good news, bad news, after 9/11, flights for just, like, you can get a flight for $50 to New York and a hotel for $60 a night. So I got to know her manager and her work. So I would, you know, take these trips out there and get to know, help her get dressed because she had arthritis and work on this. But here's the thing. Anita, sometimes she wasn't all there. But before the show...
Yeah.
Robbie, her manager, Robbie would show lots of videos of her from back with Stan Kenton, Benny Goodman, and all that.
Yeah.
But when she got on with the band, I mean, she might not know where she was or what was going on. But once they played that, and then once she got on with the band and got going, she was in charge. She was a different person. She was directing the band to trade trade fours, trade twos, whatever.
Yeah.
And you could
it was a natural muscle
like
reaction.
You can see the young Anita coming out. And there was even the publisher of her bio, High Times, Hard Times, even the young girl who worked in his at his publisher sat by me, and she was, I think, in her late 20s, and she said, "I see what you mean now." She says, "I feel like I'm watching her on stage, and I'm watching her morph back to a much younger self as the music goes on." Now, do you feel like you were watching these people, like when they were reminiscing and having laughs, like you could picture what they were like?
Oh, yeah, especially when that's one of the reasons why I did the round table at the beginning. My goal was to, originally it was supposed to be, Earl was supposed to be there, and he got sick. And I wanted to do roundtables all the time because what it does is you could bring something up and someone else jumps in over them. And that's kind of what I based it on was Broadway Danny Rose, the movie, and Barry Levinson, Diner. Because my my favorite films are always when they're being, you know, dialogue is flowing back and forth, and they're jumping on each other's lines. And with those guys, I knew all I had to do is say something and they would go, and then something would react and they go, and then someone else would jump in. Those were always the better interviews. When you're talking about, you know, like when I was talking about interviewing, two people, Snuff Garrett was phenomenal. Snuff Garrett, it might be one of my next documentaries. That's what I'm working on next. And he was a producer at the time, and you either loved Snuff or hated Snuff. Because Snuff was tough. He was business, all business. He was the first producer to get a penny an album at Liberty, anywhere. He established what it was like today. But Snuff was about business, and that's what this place, you always have the business first. And so when I got, unfortunately, Snuff, I didn't put a lot of them in because I had to cut stuff out. But when I went to Glenn, you know, it was around 2003, I think 2002. And for Glenn, that point, we started seeing these touches of something. Now we know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
But I would ask Glenn something, and he would be able to talk about the past, and it just fly. You know, he would just go through it. And but then I'd ask him a question, five different questions, get the same answer. So I knew there was issues. But for Glenn, the past was his favorite. It was when he didn't have the responsibility of being the leader. He was the side guy. He was the, you know, guy that came in and did the solos and walked away or sang back up and walked away. Once he got the show, now he had the pressure of all his that life on top of him. So he always loved the second part of, or the first part of his life was really special to him.
It's sad now to watch.
Denny, this has been so much fun, and we're out of time. I'm so grateful that you gave me. You're so generous with your time tonight, and I know that was a lot more work than just as we know all the work that the Wrecking Crew put into every single song that we've all loved. We can't imagine how much work you and your crew put into creating this documentary for all of us to love and fall in love with you all over again. We'll never know. And so we'll look forward to your next, if you do the next doc on Snuff Garrett. We can't wait. And you are always, we'd always be delighted to have you back here at Madame Perry Salon. And I will have all of your information. WreckingCrewFilm.com. It's WreckingCrewFilm.com is the website. And also it's WreckCrewFilm is the Twitter handle. And you're also the Wrecking Crew documentary also has a Facebook page. And I will continue, as I have, to share all the information for people to find Wrecking Crew documentary anywhere they can. And someone you need to buy a gift for and you have
Use the promo code on a discount to use the Father's Day when you go to the website, and they'll give you a discount somewhere on anything.
Oh, okay. Fantastic.
Oh, great.
Put that on there, Father's Day promo. All right, now tomorrow, that's great. Thank you. Tomorrow night we have Deidre Haight and Will Arndt. Will created the film What the Bleep Do We Know, and then he married Deidre, and they've got their own book, the not-so-little book of surprises. They'll be here tomorrow night, and they'll give away a book to someone. But again, thank you, Dave Tedesco. And by the way, I also fell in love with your mother. She's absolutely enchanting in the film, and her too.
Thank you.
But thank you. Please come back anytime, and we're grateful for your time tonight. I wish you all the best.
Have a good one.
Bye.